Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I meet with Innes Henderson, founder of S2S Architects. Innes built his practice with the kind of focus and adaptability that reminds me of a hummingbird. Professionally, he has developed a specialized architectural process that's all about being intentional, agile, and aligning his skills with his clients' project needs. Like a hummingbird, it's about finding that sweet spot, moving with precision, and leaving a lasting impression wherever you go. And Innes has gone to over 7 states with his license all across the Midwest and 2 countries. So sit back and enjoy. Today, I get to meet with Innes Henderson down in Winona, Minnesota, and talking about his firm, S2S Architects, and about his practice, where he travels through many states, serving many different clients.
Thank you for reaching out to me. Great to be in your company again. It's always a pleasure meeting in these settings and being able to talk about our work and what we do.
Great. Could you tell us a little bit about your practice, when you got started, and the kind of work you do?
Sure. So I started in 2018. So I'm coming up on, I think that makes it 7 years of practice on my own. It's been an interesting trajectory. And sometimes when I talk with people about it, I use the analogy of raising kids, which we were actually doing at the same time. So when you think about it, when you have a newborn and an infant, you're up all night with it, you're trying to keep it alive and everything. And in some respects, there's a little bit of a parallel there with what happens when you've got a practice that you have this new thing, but you're maybe not 100% sure of what you're meant to be doing and how to nurture it. And you're flying by the seat of your pants. Some might say that you're flying solo with it, but you're definitely trying to get it to a place that you can feel comfortable about and ultimately be able to sleep at night. So to use that analogy, my one is 7 years old now, and I can, to a lesser extent, close the door at night and get some rest and things like that. But there are always plenty interesting moments as well, and you never know what's around the corner. As far as the work that I do, a lot of the work ends up being maybe, you know, community driven. I've never relied, being in a smaller municipality, of all the work coming from my own front doorstep. When I started my firm in 2018, I think I experienced what most practitioners would probably call a bounce effect. And that to me was that when you start a firm, and when you start doing things, there tends to be that initial time of referrals and interest and activity and this new thing. And quite often some of that can come from established relationships, people who like working with you, who want to continue working with you. And through that, you can begin to, in my case, very organically develop a network of connections. One of the things that was very important for me was that when I started my own firm in 2018, we'd only been in Minnesota for about 2 years. So we were in New Mexico for 5 years, and then we moved up to Minnesota. And normally I would have thought that the trajectory and the arc to starting a firm would have probably have involved maybe having more of those connections established as a base. But that's not always the case. And I think that what I found was that that's not always as necessary as what you might think it is, because as you do work and as you promote a name and a brand and roll that out and develop it, that a lot of those organic marketing by virtue of that bounce effect, initially, if you can capitalize on that, I think that that's one good way to, you know, generally get a good spread and a good distribution. My history is that I have usually found myself in practices that are more generalist in nature. I've never worked for a retail or a hospitality or a municipal or justice focused practice. Therefore, I think that a lot of my professional conditioning has been such that I've learned over the years to be adaptive, flexible, responsive to a number of different project types, number of different settings, delivery methods, locations. And that's maybe not for everyone, and I understand that. But I think for me, that what that enabled me to do when I started my practice was to consider a broad range of project types and be able to take them on. After all, if somebody comes to you saying, well, have you ever done this project before? You can always answer, well, just like every other project I've ever done, there will always be the first one of that type of project. And then you go from there and you can build your portfolio from there.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I love your initial analogy about how you describe raising a firm, like raising a child, and acknowledges how hard it is in the beginning. But it also looks forward to the systems that you put in place, the discipline you put in place that can help it grow better, maybe, and have less outbursts of the firm later in life. But still, I'm only 5 years in, so I'm still learning about that as well. And what an interesting way to start your practice, especially in a new geography. But I'm sure some of that former geography also helped with the spread of where you do work. I'm curious if any of your connections continued forward from previous jobs, or if you had to kind of start over when you talk about these, this building of this network and these bouncing of referrals. Did you have to start from scratch, or did some of those clients come from former work?
I was very surprised at the extent of goodwill that clients who I had worked with in the past had approached me afterwards and had come to me and said, I want to work with you. So it's very gratifying and rewarding to know that somewhere along the way that you have left an impression, and it's been a positive one. And that has came round to reward you in a way that is obviously beneficial to starting a practice. I remember reading Art Gensler's book not long after I started. And there was one quote in there that was just so simple, but it really struck with me. It was to the effect of, where our clients want us to be, that's where we'll be. And it's so simple, because if I had, for example, decided that I was going to limit my practice to a 50-mile radius or anything like that, then that would have been very limiting for me in terms of the breadth and depth and scale of work that I would have been able to have taken on. In fact, when I started, most of the work that I was getting was actually out of state, again, through that bounce referral of one project that was my launch project, which was in Rochester, Minnesota. And I will always be grateful for that project and to that client, because that was the seed that planted the roots, that grew the sapling, that is growing and growing yet today.
So how did it grow naturally from that first initial project? Was it the people you worked with? Was it that you could show it on your website? How did that move forward and grow into more projects?
So I think for me that it was relationship-based, it was referral-based, and it was very, very personal. So another quote that comes to mind is, people might not necessarily remember what you say, but they will always remember how you make them feel. So if you can leave people with a positive experience and people walk away and say, this turned out well, I would do that again. Even if it was the only chance that you may have in your entire life to do a built project, which for us, we do it all the time. When we pivot and look at that from the client's perspective, many, many people who may only do this once in the course of their life or their professional career. So it's really important, I think, to be able to leave the job, leave the project, and leave that relationship better than you found it, in a place that if somebody had the chance, that yes, they would want to do it all over again. So I think that putting in that effort, positioning yourself in a place that people will be happy to refer you because that experience has been rewarding and has been positive. From there, then you can start to grow your presence and your brand, which for me wasn't so much media driven, but that from the nascent steps that you take and having those projects and telling the story of what you do, to me, was very foundational in as far as you know, of course, that when you start a firm that you're on that 90-day runway, it's 30 days to find the work, 30 days to do the work, 30 days to get paid for the work. So as you start to build that up, then you can get that momentum. And then within that, you get good marketable projects. There's part of those that are things that you can show and roll out and present and tell a story about who you are, how you work, why you work, and what you want to do.
There is a reality to that timeline that people need to understand when they're just getting started and taking flight with this. I am curious if you would say that the growth of your projects is more anchored by who your clients are or the project type.
That is probably going to be driven a little bit more on the client side.
Your website outlines a multitude of project types, and you've talked about your services as being a generalist. And so I'm curious how that spread happens.
So this, I think, speaks to the part of architects that always want to be looking at the next project. That, yes, we have our workload, but we've constantly got to be looking at what is next and what we want to be doing next, and what we feel we can take on next. And I think as architects, we've got big jaws. You know, we want to trap that big fish. And for me, I think that as I started my practice when I already had 20 years of experience, I had, within those 20 years, worked for sole principals, mid-size offices, 500-person firms with offices throughout the country and overseas. So as an individual, as a professional, I had built up a considerable amount of project experience on large projects, small projects, a lot of different types. When you start your own firm, that you want to be able to demonstrate that you have the capacity and the experience to take on that type of work. Because there may be a perception that if you're a sole principal, that maybe you're, or a sole practitioner, that it's house additions or, you know, smaller commercial work or something like that. But you and I know that that's not the case. And I think that there's a lot of education that you have to do in order to try and convey what your abilities are and what your capacities are. And I think that it's also interesting as well that having worked in the larger firms, and when we do the marketing for the big presentations and we talk about having our giant team of 30 staff, 50 staff, 100 staff, is it 30, 50 or 100 people that are going to be working on that project that you're trying to land? No, it's not. We know that. It's a best kept secret that it's going to be a very small team. And sometimes it might be you that's doing that. So we have those skills. We have that ability. We have the capacity. So if you have that experience, it's a case of trying to build out your portfolio to reflect what your capacity and capabilities are.
No, that's a great point. And so specifically, what are the key factors that say, yes, I can do this project with this client? People may reach out and you may have to say no, but what are some of the ways that you know that a client or project is aligned with what you can do for them?
You would be surprised at how much of that comes from your gut. I think that as sole practitioners, we have to rely on our instincts maybe a little bit more than more resourced larger firms would have, because it is a little bit of a high wire act that when you are on the wire, there's a lot of winds and external forces that are coming at you that may try and knock you off. And you have to be careful and make sure that you've got a read of where you are and who's coming to you to make sure that your values are aligned, that the project goals are realistic, and you are able to execute. I've never so much been bothered by the how of it, as far as, like I say, the first time you do a new project type, it's always the first time. And then after that, you've done it. So you have that experience. And if we only did the type of work that we've done before and you're starting out, then, well, you're never going to get any work, or you're never going to be able to take anything along because you may not have that. So sanity checking sometimes will occur in a few different ways. It could come from the reputation and the referral of the client, if there is one, and doing a little bit of pre-screening and reading around and getting to know each other. I don't think that every potential commission that comes in the door is one that you should see yourself as having an obligation to take on, regardless of the circumstances. Because again, we're up on the high wire and we don't want to get knocked off that. And it doesn't take much to buffet that wire in either direction. Goals have to be realistic as well. The tripartite fundamentals of any project being, of course, budget, schedule, and quality, are all of these lying within practical reason? I think that that there are some good due diligence steps that people can take. And everyone probably has their own approach to that, because everyone's practice is driven in part by an extension of their personality and what they feel they want to take on and what kind of person they are as well. So when you bring it back down to the human part of it, if you will, and that personal or professional relationship, you also have to think about what that relationship is going to look like once you get underway with that project as well. And are you fundamentally aligned and compatible and seeing the same project that they're seeing as well when they bring it to you?
So yeah, let's get personal with that. What personal strengths, hopes, and dreams did you build into starting S2S Architects?
Well, what's interesting is that when I went through architecture school, I never came out of it, or nor did I go into architecture school with a specific goal of being the head of my own practice, or having my own practice, or having an ownership or a management. It was design first, project first, and I want to be in architecture because that's who I am as a person. And for many years, being in private practice served that very, very well. Here's an interesting fact. I dug this one up when I was, as I've been doing job talks with high schools and talking with people about careers and what architecture looks like. And I can't remember the exact number, but this really struck with me that out of all the architects practicing in the United States, that there is a clear and overwhelming majority, and I think the number is about 70%, who work in either firms with less than five people or less, or as sole practitioners. How did 70% of us end up in that situation? And how did we get trained to be able to thrive in that situation? Katie, I can tell you that when I went through architecture school, we had zero firm management, business ownership, financial guidance, or anything. But we were told to set that to the side and say, focus on the design, focus on the process. Katie, what was your experience? What did you, when you went through architecture school and your pathway to it, was it academic? Did you go off and do an MBA at night? Was it mentorship?
I think you're pointing to why I felt like this podcast was needed, because there are so many of us practicing. We feel like we're solo, but that's kind of a joke of the name, is that we're flying solo, but we're not alone in this practice. There are so many doing this. And for me, I came into architecture from an art and art history background, and I took as many business and economics classes as I could along the way with that liberal arts degree. And then after getting my seven exams done, I devoted my extra time while working for other firms to learning about business, because I did want to start my own and I didn't know how to do it. And so that's been the last, probably 10 or 11 years of just absorbing as much business advice and having conference sessions about it and having like interviewing people about it, just to try and learn that aspect of it, in lieu of I couldn't justify going back for an MBA. So I'm trying to, but that is what many of us do, is that we try to piece together this business advice and what we need to learn to run a business on the side of, we were trained for this different profession. We were trained as architects to solve problems. And there's something to be said for creative problem solving that can be applied to business solutions as well as to buildings. So that's kind of where I'm coming at with it. But how do you feel like that leap into your own practice went? That's how, what I'm hearing from you is that you love doing architecture. And it Right. sounds like whatever it takes for you to be able to do the architecture and change your clients' lives, you will do that. And so is that sort of the impetus that started S2S?
There are options within your career other than just being paid to sit at a desk. You can make that your own desk. And that isn't for everyone. But I think that there gets a point within your career when you know what you want, and you know what you want to do and how you want to do it. And sometimes the only way to get the professional satisfaction and the meaning for what you're doing is to just do it yourself. And it can sometimes be a long path to get to that point, to figure that out. But once you get there, things can happen fairly quickly. And for some people, that can happen in as quickly as about a 2 to 3 week period, that from the moment of deciding that this is where I want to be and this is what I think I'm going to do, that it is amazing how quickly you can make a life-altering decision like that. And yes, for me, that was about 2 weeks from the light bulb coming on above my head to putting plans in place to coming down the stairs in my house and starting up my computer and having day one at my own firm. Now, meanwhile, if you find me at the grocery store, I can quite happily spend 45 minutes with two cans of baked beans reading the labels, trying to figure out which one shall I do, this one or that one. And those are the types of decisions that you can sometimes get hyper-fixated over, but just thinking, okay, this is what I want to do. I see it. I'm going to go after it. I'm on it. And you can do that. And it surprised me because I'm not normally that type of thinker.
And so what was that dream that you said, light bulb on, this is what I'm going to do?
Well, I think that it was having the creative freedom to work in a situation that I would be able to decide for myself what I wanted to prioritize, what I'm passionate about, what I care about, and be able to explore that within my practice. I've always been a big believer of there's no such thing as bad experience. So even when you are in a situation or you see things that you think, well, I personally wouldn't do that, or that's not what I would want to do, or I would go in a different direction. We don't want to learn from our own mistakes. We want to learn from everyone else's mistakes.
That can sometimes be less daunting, to take lessons from the lessons. I am curious, when you do these projects, are you doing everything yourself now? Or are you collaborating with other architects or outsourcing some of the task work? How do you handle these projects?
There are things that I am getting better about starting to do as far as outsourcing and recognizing where I want to be and what my focus should be. Because one of the things that I think that we really don't do a great job of finding out from our clients is we know they want to hire us. And that's great and that's rewarding. And quite often the conversation stops there. But we never ever or very seldom ask why they want to hire us. And that's a vital piece of feedback that I think that if we knew that, that is telling us, without us having to go and do that discovery and figure out ourselves, what our strengths are. Because whatever they are telling you that you are doing right and that is what you are getting a reputation or building a brand on, you probably want to be doing more of it. So therefore, don't be focusing on the things that aren't building value to you and to what you want to do. Those are probably the things that you need to be looking at getting some help or outsourcing. So specifically for me, one thing that I now partner with some great firms for helping me with is rendering, visualization and presentation work. Graphic design falls into that bucket as well. I recognize that there are people out there who are far better, far quicker, far more trained, have access to far more software and have got deeper resources that can turn around a far better product at a far better price point in a far shorter period of time than I could ever stand a chance of doing. There is a value that I could scarcely put into words when you trust a firm to be able to take your vision and bring it to life and give you exactly what you want. And it allows me to focus on the things that I think I'm good about.
And so how do you serve 8 different states?
I believe just now I am licensed in 8 states and 2 countries, yes.
Okay, what's the other country?
Well, the United Kingdom, because
okay,
I grew up in Scotland, and I went to architecture school in Aberdeen, Robert Gordon University, Scott Sutherland School of Architecture. Great experience. When I graduated, I worked in private practice and got registered in the United Kingdom, and I still maintain my license. As far as how do I serve them, that to me is simple. And again, it goes back to what Art Gensler said. Where your clients want you to be, that's where you are. So if you need to go there, that's what you do. And when you just dissolve the geographical boundary, it becomes really easy to do that. I've always done it. It's always been second nature. I now have this 7-year-old firm and this presence and this footprint in the upper Midwest. Then to me, to go to Wisconsin or Michigan or Nebraska, South Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado or New Mexico, that's easy. That's easy.
That's interesting. And so are you you're following your clients there. Are these clients with repeat projects that happen to span across different states, or are you meeting these clients in different ways and it's different projects?
Yes, a lot of my workload is from repeat clients. There's quite a lot of it. Another pillar of the work that I do is Main Street and downtown and historic and adaptive reuse and revitalization and reactivation of historic buildings and downtowns and keeping that vibrant. So there's a visibility in those spaces as well, be it whether it's within the work that you do and getting that drive-by recognition, or having the very local word-of-mouth referrals, or whether it could be doing the conference circuit and presenting, whether it's on other activities such as serving on a Heritage Preservation Commission or a Planning Commission or something like that. We want to be talking to the policymakers, the shape makers, the decision makers, and the other people who are in businesses who get to make those decisions. That's where we want to be. And I think that it's interesting that how many people across the profession will go to their state or national AIA convention, but maybe not go to the NIOP convention or go to Preserve Minnesota or go to any other related industry. It could be a healthcare or some other venue that is focused on a part of practice where you're going to get exposure and visibility to the people you really need to.
That's such a good reminder. And so what have you found to be most helpful?
I think that the fundamentals of it are absolutely crucial. Yes, visibility. We can talk about websites, we can talk about flyers and cards and going to conferences and everything. Is that what gets a proposal over the line? Is that what gets your phone ringing? In the world of a sole practitioner, sometimes you maybe just might not have the time to be able to get into that and discover that before you've got to go off and do something else. But for me, I think that it's the fundamentals of why we're here, why you want to do it, how you want to do it. Again, we might not remember what was said, but people remember how we make them feel. So experience is a huge thing. The dialogue, the relationship, building that and valuing that, and making sure that your clients are being understood and being heard. And none of this may sound like it's rocket science, but it is so fundamental in a relationship-driven profession that we are, that we really have to work on that, and we really have to focus on that. And that builds us the foundation that we can go from there.
Very true. I very much agree with that. I'm curious, can you summarize your foundations of your firm in three words?
Oh, yes, I can. And if you were to ask me next week, I might have three completely different words. But I would say experience, intelligence, and consensus. I've spoken a lot about experience, and it's even in my logo, Build Experience, the play on words of that. And not just the experience as the output, but the experience as the verb and the doing, and how is it feeling when you're doing it. Because like I said, you want people to feel like they are your only client when you are working with them. You want that experience for people who may only get one shot at life to build a building, start their business, do their custom home for their family. Many people are only getting one shot at that. And we really have to recognize that and see it from that standpoint. So experience for me, and also the experience of the firm that I can offer with my background of having large project experience and being able to bring that to the table and offer that as a value. Intelligence, because we really need to think hard about what we're doing, why we're doing things. We need to interrogate not only the ideas, but we need to interrogate our own questions. I've always said that we need to ask uncommonly detailed questions, and we should never ever run away from the answers either, because that will uncover the things and differentiate us from other people who are working in design backgrounds, and help to bring that value and to differentiate us as architects. And the last one being consensus, we want to make sure that we are building a community, whether it is around our conference room table, whether it is on the end of a phone, or whether it as a community building workshop. I know, Katie, that you have been involved with the AIE Minnesota, is it the design workshop subcommittee?
Yeah, Minnesota Design Team.
Mm-hmm. Design Team, that's it. So it's a version of that, that you are bringing that design expertise and those design skills and abilities to be able to facilitate and workshop solutions in places that may not have that expertise on their doorstep, or they may not know how to get from A to B. So whether it happens at the macro scale, the micro scale, or the regional scale, again, it's an instinctive part of our training. And I think it's really something that is foundational to what I do, and like I said, what I think we should be doing as a profession.
I think that's a great call to action, and it's so relevant to creating a better experience. And I love your logo, Build Experience. There's so much wordplay on that, and it's exciting to hear that, not just the build aspect, but also how people are feeling in these spaces, how your client feels when working with you. I love it all around. I think I'm ready to share a bird with you. I wasn't, through this interview, I almost second guessed it because I had a thought about which bird. And then in hearing about your process and different things, a lot of different things came up and ideas came to mind, but I think I'm going to settle on a hummingbird. Ooh. And the reason being, it's a funny wordplay. Henderson, Minnesota is actually the National Ruby-Throated Hummingbird Center.
Really?
It just got established, so yeah.
We have wolves, we have owls, we have eagles, I don't think we have a national bear, or we do have a bear center.
We have a loon, National Loon Center, And now we have a National Hummingbird Center. And I love these places. And I tried to find any other national centers, and they're all in Minnesota. It's just a Minnesota thing. Yes. And actually, you're close to the Eagle Center. But the reason I would call you a hummingbird is thinking about how, well, one, they migrate. So they are a resilient little bird who's migrating 2,000 miles every year. And so the fact that you travel, the fact that you're nimble enough, you're a lean enough practice to be traveling alone to all these different places, to all these different projects and all these different clients. Hummingbirds are very specialized. And you kept saying you were a generalized practice in the types of projects you take on. But the more and more I hear about what you do as an architect, that expertise, that experience and that intelligence feels like you are very specialized in how you apply your architectural practice and how you run your projects with your clients to have that specialized experience. And there's that consensus idea reminds me of the compatibility of a hummingbird to the flowers that it serves. But a hummingbird will visit many, many, many different types of flowers, many, many different types of projects are in your practice. It's a huge, beautiful garden of projects. And hummingbirds are smart enough to remember which flowers they've visited, and they know how long it takes for the nectar to be resupplied. And so that kind of plays to that service, going back to those clients to serve them in new ways and just keeping that relationship. But even just the image of a hummingbird, this beautiful design, and just so focused. And it sounds like you are doing so much in your practice. You're almost operating on a different frequency than a lot of us architects can even handle. You're doing so many things at once. It's all it comes down to that focus, where you see the head of that hummingbird coming in, and the way that you touch a project sounds very specific, sounds very intentional. And it just, there's like these wings just flying like crazy. You can't even see it on the side. And you are operating at that high frequency, but delivering that consistent and quality service to your clients.
That is a very perceptive analogy there. And I like the hummingbird. I'm really pleased that I got the hummingbird and no one said, well, you're a cuckoo or a magpie or some other bird. Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing about this. And it occurred to me this morning before we got on the podcast that there is also another very strong character pairing between not just the types of birds, but birds and solo practitioners. And that is, when you look at all the different types of birds in the world, we don't just have, oh, that is a bird and there's no subset of species. You know, we have eagles, there's peregrine falcons, there's penguins, there's ducks, there's loons. And look at all these different things that one of those types of birds can do, but the other one cannot if its life depended on it. And that, to me, underscores adaptability. And that, I think, is a huge thing of what we also have to do in order to survive and thrive in our sole practitioner environment, is that we have to be flexible, we have to be rapid response, and we have to have that adaptability to changing workloads, changing economic conditions, other external threats, because we are far less insulated and we are going to feel them far more than larger firms. Or maybe some larger firms will say, well, we get to feel those too. And yes, that is right. When there is an economic downturn, we all feel that. I think that our stakes are a little more absolute because we are maybe in a nest and that might not have a shelter on top of it, and we've maybe got a little bit more exposure. So I like the analogy, and I think that you could probably go further with that had we had more time to talk about why birds and sole practitioner architecture is really a convergent theme. There's definitely an overlapping covalent bond there.
It is, and it recognizes how we have to be very decisive and be lean in our practice to be able to handle the currents that can come at us. It's good to have different types of practice. It's good to be finding your strengths and finding ways to reflect those strengths in your practice, because you are able to serve so many people with your design skills and your architectural talents when you're able to shape that firm around yourself. We may be all trained the same, but we do vastly different things. And that's, I think we're all aiming for that, whether we're in firms or we're doing our own thing. It's a nice thing when you find that resonance with your clients and you feel like you're practicing your architectural craft to its fullest extent and still continuing to grow in this lifelong profession.
Katie, you are absolutely right. And that's a great way to sum it up. I love what you're doing here with the Flying Solo podcast, because there's one thing that it's doing, and that is to be the resource of that conversation and that glue that exists or should exist between this 70% body of practicing architects being sole practitioners or whatever that number is, because there's a lot of us. And like you say in the title of the podcast, we're flying solo, but we're really a flock, and it should feel more like a flock. We shouldn't feel like this is something that we have to do in isolation, nor invent from the ground up every single time.
And I think there's people recognizing that and starting to fill that gap, which is so exciting. Like you said, the technology now is making us more global in some aspects, and we should be leveraging that to help each other fly to new heights with our professional and personal practice.
Exactly.
Well, thank you. Ines, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I just love hearing about your practice and how you've come at this. It's so helpful to interview folks who have started right out of school or who have started mid-career or late career. It means that you build your business a little differently and you're able to approach your clients and serve your clients in your own unique way. So thank you so much for sharing that. It's been a delight to talk with you as always.
It has been an absolute pleasure. It's been great to connect with you again. Thank you for the invite, and I can't wait to see where the podcast goes after this.
Thanks. Ines Henderson founded his firm, S2S Architects, after refining his architectural skills. He loves being an architect. He lives to design and practice architecture, and he is willing to go wherever it takes for him to practice his craft to the best of his abilities. His passion is unmatched, and many aspects of his practice reflect the agility and precision of a hummingbird. There are three qualities of his practice that distinguish it from other sole practitioners. First, S2S Architects is highly specialized in its practice. Ines leverages his years of experience to provide highly refined processes and intelligent design solutions to his clients. He founded his firm out of a desire to practice architecture to the best of his abilities. Like a hummingbird's wings, his systems and design approach are working behind the scenes at lightning speed, hardly visible to his clients. What his clients see is his solid focus and intentional design, like that hummingbird hovering over a trumpeter vine to surgically extract nectar from the narrow flowers. This precision comes from years of practice, and he can approach his clients' problems with exceptional clarity. But to run a specialized practice requires letting go or outsourcing tasks to collaborators, which leads to our second point. Agile collaboration. That is how S2S Architects is able to apply highly specialized experience to a large variety of projects. Ines doesn't try to do it all. He knows what he is best at and is ready to apply that to projects far and wide. Just as a hummingbird samples hundreds of flowers and is able to remember when each flower replenishes its nectar, Ines has built a strong network that he can serve with intentionality. He can adapt his methods to solve specific problems and refine his approach to solve the next challenges his clients face, whether they are expanding across a region or delving into a different building typology. His approach to projects hinges on aligning his solutions with the client's priorities and leaning on the skills of other professionals as necessary, he is able to build consensus with his clients and leave things on a positive note, ready for him to return if they need additional services. And sometimes following through with these clients' needs requires a bit of travel, which leads to our final point, being willing to adapt and migrate. When Innes has built a strong relationship with a client, they want to continue working with him as their business grows, or they recommend his services to an adjacent agency or business partner. He leverages his firm size and adapts to new geographies. He doesn't let a state boundary or licensure logistics get in the way of serving his best clients and projects. He stays adaptable and he migrates with them, which further strengthens his ability to collaborate. Hummingbirds migrate hundreds to thousands of miles each year. They leverage their speed and agility to travel across North America, tasting from different gardens along the way. S2S Architects has found their sweet spot in practice. The work Innes does each day fuels his practice, missionally and financially. He continues to hone his special skills to broaden the impact of his services. If you have a special set of skills in architecture and would like to build your firm around that passion, that drive, then consider how Innes has built S2S Architects like a hummingbird. Hone your skills, build a network, and find partners. Because leveraging collaboration can be the key to specializing as a sole practitioner. When you find that sweet spot, it isn't about size. It's about showing up with intention, agility, and purpose. This episode was brought to you in collaboration with Entree Architect, which is a fantastic community for finding like-minded entrepreneurs who are there to support you in your business journey. Please subscribe, share, and join the Flying Solo Movement community. We are just taking flight. Please join this journey for ongoing inspiration, support, and resources. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Katie Kengis. My hope is to encourage aspiring entrepreneurs and architects to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.